Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following presentation takes place at the 2010 Forum for Primary Prevention Advocates called Ending Violence Against Women and Teen Dating Violence. Keynote speaker Jackson Katz, anti-sexist male activist, talks about the need for more men to become involved in the work to end violence against women.
Let me say, as I begin, I look out. There are some men here, but not that many of us. This is a problem. Not a problem because the women who came here. Your leadership and women's leadership has been the bulwark of all of this work. And all the great work that's happening among men, both in the United States in a multicultural sense and around the world in an international sense, all the cutting-edge work that's being done with men on these issues is as a result of women's leadership. And none of the great work that men are doing would be possible were it not for the leadership of women. And women will continue to be the leaders in this work. And my work is indebted to women's leadership. Every man in this room, I would imagine, our work is indebted to women's leadership. So there's no doubt about any of that. The fact is, however, we need a whole lot more men involved in this work if we're going to get anywhere. Now, I travel all over the United States and all over the world, and I give lots of talks and trainings in domestic and sexual violence conferences. And who do you think shows up at most domestic and sexual violence conferences? Even here in 2010, it's mostly women, right? For example, a couple of months ago, I was in Glasgow, Scotland, giving a presentation at a rape crisis center's big conference. There were 150 people at this rape prevention conference, and there were 5 men out of 150 people, and I was one of the 5 men. And as often happens at such events, many of the women there are grateful that there are even men there at all. I was approached by women who would say, thank you so much for being here. It's so important to have a man here, and we really need men's involvement, and we appreciate it. And I have to say, I do appreciate being appreciated, but it's also embarrassing. And I know that I can speak for a lot of men in this room, including some of my colleagues, that it's embarrassing as a man to be congratulated for doing what we know men should be doing and need to be doing. And if we can get to the point in our society where we have a sexual assault conference and 50% of the people are men and nobody remarks upon that fact, all right, if we have a domestic violence or teen dating violence conference and 50% of the people there are men and nobody says, oh my goodness, how did this happen? This is unbelievable. Guess what? We'll have arrived at a society with a dramatically reduced rate of domestic and sexual violence and teen dating violence, because in that society, it'll be expected that men address these issues. It'll be expected that men confront each other's attitudes and behaviors. It'll be expected that adult men provide strong and directed leadership to young men and boys about how to treat both girls and women and other boys and men. And in that society, where we will have changed the social norms in masculinity and male culture, the rates of domestic and sexual violence will come way down, because the typical perpetrator of domestic and sexual violence or teen relationship violence is not a sick man, he's not a sociopath, he's not mentally ill, he's not deeply disturbed, he's a normal guy, he's an average guy, he's just like many of the guys that we all know, not even in the work, I'm talking about in our families, in our friendship circles, in our schools, right? I mean, I've been keeping a file for a number of years now. I actually read brick and mortar newspapers, right? I actually read newspapers. And I actually cut out articles, which I know dates me quite a bit in the Google era. And I put them in a file, in a filing cabinet, right next to my 8-track tapes. And what I've been looking for in these articles over the years are stories about men who have done something bad. I'm sorry to say, it's not that difficult to find such articles, and specifically men's violence against women. And when people are quoted in these articles, what I'm looking for are quotes from friends and family members and teammates and co-workers of men who have done something horrible, who typically say something like, we had no idea there was a problem here, or this is not the Jim that I know, this is not my friend. The guy that I know and the guy that you're reading about, it's not the same person. I mean, there's got to be either a mistake here or that, you know, something crazy happened, because this is not the guy that I know. He's a nice guy, he's a family guy, whatever. You hear this over and over again, don't you? I think people would be comforted if the typical perpetrator was a sick, disturbed, you know, Freddy Krueger type of individual, because then we could distance ourselves from him. We could say, that guy's twisted, that guy's whack, you know, and we have nothing in common with that guy, which is a way of distancing ourselves from him, right? And by the way, this is one of the ways that racism works in this discourse, right? Because a lot of white people are comforted by saying it's those kinds of men that treat their women like shit. It's those kinds of men, meaning those, which is the racialized other who is doing the bad behavior, if you will, rather than we, say in this case, white people, where it's in our communities too, you know, but it's easy to distance yourself or ourselves than it is to take ownership of it. And, you know, true wisdom on these issues, for, especially on the part of men, resides not in thinking about how different men are who are abusive, different from us, but rather how much we have in common with them. Now, I'm not saying that all men are potential rapists and all men are potential abusers. I'm not going there. I don't like that. I don't like how it comes off. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that the guy who just murdered his family, you know, who's down the street from me, or the teen who's, you know, I'm no longer a teen, but, you know, the teenager who's on my team in high school or in my class who just beat up his girlfriend, that guy grew up in the same community. He's like drinks the same water as I do. He consumes the same media. He might attend the same religious institutions. He's part of my community. Yes, he's got some problems and he's got some issues, but he's really not radically different from me and from us men. Now, this is not exactly an easy thing to come to, because what it requires is a level of introspection, looking inward, that makes a lot of people, especially in this case, a lot of men, very uncomfortable. But it's where we need to go, I think. And if we want to do real primary prevention, if we really want to change the social norms that produce the outcomes that we're always seeing, we have to ask these kind of hard questions. And we have to look critically at how we socialize boys in this society, how we define manhood. And yes, in subcultural, you have to talk about different subcultural communities and ideologies, but there was also a larger ideological system. There's also a larger community that we have to look at. What does it mean to be a man in this society? And how are we socializing boys, even in 2010, to be men in ways that some of them predictably act out in abusive ways? The rates of domestic and sexual violence in our society are way beyond individual perpetrators acting out in some pathological sense. It's obviously systemic. And smart thinking in the 21st century, and in the 20th century, but certainly in the 21st century, smart thinking makes these kinds of macro, sort of overall sort of observations about the culture. This is not about individual perpetration. Of course, individuals need to be held accountable for their behavior. They also need help and treatment, and especially when it comes to teen, you know, dating violence. Some boys who are acting out, it's early enough that you can really make a big difference. I mean, part of the reason why I and a lot of other people in this room are passionate about the subject of teen relationship abuse or dating violence is that you know that the success rate is much higher, likely. I mean, you know, because the earlier you get to these young men who are acting out in some of these ways, the more likelihood of success and the more likelihood that you're gonna prevent a lot of pain going forward in that boy, soon to be man's life, and the people around him. But we do have a long, long way to go to create a culture where the social norms have shifted in the way that I'm talking about. So I've prepared a number of different pieces of my presentation to hopefully give you some ideas about how to think about some of the issues that we need to think about to change those social norms. And I'm going to share them with you. And then, again, then I'm going to open up the floor before I go to the media stuff. And here's why. I know from experience as an educator that when media enters the room, it kind of takes over. You know what I'm saying? So when I start showing you these really powerful visuals and, you know, video clips and everything, people want to talk about media, and I appreciate that. It's incredibly interesting and important. But I'm going to give you a space before we get there to comment about what I've been saying and what I will say, okay? Teen dating violence is a men's issue. Obviously, it's a women's issue too, and so please keep in mind that the whole presentation that I'm giving, I understand how incredibly important women's role in leadership and prevention and any number of different, and victim advocacy, all the issues that women are involved in, they're involved in, but I'm focusing on men and why this needs to be discussed as and seen as a men's issue. Teen dating violence is a men's issue. And by the way, this reciprocal violence stuff, I mean, I'm going to say this colloquially rather than as an academic, This drives me crazy, all right? It drives me crazy to talk about, you know, we have, it's not really a gender issue, it's really a men's issue, women's issue, it's girls abusive to boys, boys abusive, let's grow up, okay? This is not what's going on in the world that I live in. It was a men's issue. Yes, there are girls who have some issues. There are girls who act in ways that are inappropriate and abusive. No doubt about that. I'm not naive. No one in this field is naive about this, okay? We know this. But overwhelmingly, the problem is men abusing women and men abusing other men. And if we don't, if we're not clear on that, we have lost focus and we have lost hope for the change that needs to happen. I mean, that's my position on this subject. And I'll you know, circle back to that. But it does, it really is frustrating for some of us that we've had to spend, even waste some of our time even having to debate this point, right? Are we going to debate that racism is equally shared between, you know, people of color and white people? And the responsibility for working against racism is equally shared among people of color and white people? Are we going to argue that homophobia and heterosexism is an issue that both heterosexual people and gay and lesbian and bi people are equally responsible for preventing? Are we? So how are we going to say that with sexism? As if sexism doesn't exist. As if men and women, boys and girls, come from the same, you know, some people have issues, some people don't. This is naive in the extreme and depoliticized to talk about this subject in a gender-neutral way. And I look forward to Elizabeth Reed's luncheon keynote about this, I think, subject as well. Well, I don't want to be presumptuous. So, domestic and sexual violence prevention and teen dating violence prevention, these are men's issues, all right? And I'm gonna give you several reasons, briefly, why. Why we need to call them men's issues. The first is that by calling them women's issues, right? By calling domestic violence a women's issue, it gives a lot of men an excuse not to pay attention. A lot of men hear the term women's issues and we tend to tune it out and we think, hey, I'm a guy, that's for the girls, or that's for the women, and a lot of men literally don't get beyond the first sentence as a result. It's almost like a chip in our brain is activated, and the neural pathways take our attention in a different direction when we hear the term women's issues. This is true, by the way, of the word gender, because a lot of people hear that word, gender, and they think it means women, so they think that gender issues is synonymous with women's issues. There's some confusion about the term gender, and actually, let me illustrate that confusion by way of analogy. Let's talk for a moment about race. Okay, a lot of people hear the word race in our society and they think it means African American or Latino or Asian American or Native American or Pacific Islander or South Asian. A lot of people hear the word sexual orientation and they think it means gay, lesbian, bisexual. And a lot of people hear the word gender and they think it means women. In each case, the dominant group doesn't get paid attention to, right? As if white people don't have some sort of racial identity or belong to some racial category or construct. As if heterosexual people don't have a sexual orientation? As if men don't have a gender? This is one of the ways that dominant systems maintain and reproduce themselves, which is to say the dominant group is rarely challenged to even think about its dominance because that's one of the key characteristics of power and privilege, which is the ability to go unexamined, lacking introspection, and in fact being rendered invisible in the discourse. And one of our challenges is to make visible what has been rendered invisible. And one of the ways to do that is to start using gender-specific terms whenever possible to talk about violence perpetration. Not just talk about offenders and abusers as if it's a gender-neutral field out there. The second problem that I have with the term, the reason why I'm saying that we need to use the word men's issues rather than women's issues to talk about domestic and sexual violence has to do with perpetration, like who in fact is doing it. So let's talk about sexual violence. I know there's a lot of Cal Casa people here, and David Lee has been a great leader in this, as well as the other women and men in this room, in bringing men to the conversation, if you will. And Chad Sniffen, these are all old souls and old colleagues doing this work. Perpetration of sexual violence. Does anybody know what percentage of rape, say, let's take rape. Does anybody know what percentage of rape is perpetrated by women? It depends on estimates because, you know, we estimate when we talk about these crimes anyways, right? Because we don't have all the numbers. We estimate it's less than 1%, okay, of rape is perpetrated by women. Whether the victims are female, which they are in approximately 90% of rape cases, or male, which they are in approximately 10% of rape cases, the perpetrators of rape are overwhelmingly men, young men, and boys. Okay, so think about this. Over 99 or, you know, 98, 97, or whatever percentage you want to glam onto, okay? Over 97, 8, 9% of rape is perpetrated by men, but it's a women's issue? So rape is a women's issue, but men are the ones overwhelmingly doing it? Something like 99.8% of people in prison for rape are men. 99.8% of people in prison. Now, that's not the same as perpetration, but... And, you know, it's not just an academic observation to point out the disconnect between saying rape is a women's issue when men are the ones who are overwhelmingly doing it. It's not just an academic observation. There are certain predictable consequences that flow from this construction. And one of those predictable consequences is that on college campuses and in communities over the past generation until very recently, what has passed for prevention of rape is not really prevention at all. It's risk reduction for women and girls under the name of prevention. So girls and women, as I see people raise, you know, shaking their heads, girls and women are taught, still to this day, don't put your drink down at a party because a guy might drop a rape drug in your drink. Look in the back seat of your car before you get in. Have a man's voice on the answering machine. Have a big dog. Don't go running. Don't go running during the day. Don't go running at night. You know, buddy system. You know, on and on, right? And by the way, these are things that women and girls are taught in urban, suburban, and rural areas. All over the country. This is not just specific to any specific population. This is all over the country. There might be some regional variation. For example, I was one time in western Kansas, and I was doing this exercise in a little more extended sense about the things that women do versus the things that men do on a daily basis. And I said something like, what about parking garages? Because I had heard of a lot of women who don't park in parking garages, right? And I'm in western Kansas when I said this, like parking garages, you know. I might as well have said, you know, sub. What did you get on the subway in Fort Hays, Kansas? but the point is, there is some regional variation, but across the board, women and girls in this society are taught from an early age these risk reduction strategies, right? And by the way, these are strategies to prevent yourselves from being assaulted by men that you don't know. When we all know in this work that the majority of perpetrators are men, you know their victims, and the victim knows the perpetrator in a vast majority in some cases of cases, right? But the point is, these are not prevention strategies the way that I'm framing them, right? These are risk reduction strategies, and this is something that has been emerging in the field, more of a consciousness about the difference between risk reduction on the one hand and prevention on the other hand. Now, prevention means going to the root cause of the problem. Right, going upstream, as the public health educators use. It means going to the root cause of the problem. And the root cause of the problem of the sexual and domestic violence pandemic is not girls and women. I'm sorry. It is men and boys. But it's not just individual men and boys. It's another point that needs to be emphasized. Okay, this is not just about individuals acting out. It's about a culture that is producing men and boys who are acting out at pandemic rates. That's real prevention. That's real primary prevention, is thinking bigger, much bigger than even target populations. It's talking about the cultural context for all of this and the social and economic and political institutions that contribute to that cultural context. In particular, the socialization of boys, how we define manhood, how we raise boys, how boys interact with each other in peer cultures, and what are the norms in those peer cultures, and how are they shaped? And how do adult men play a role in shaping the norms that boys grow up with? Not just fathers and father figures, but men in positions of authority in any number of different areas in our society. What role do they play in helping to shape those social norms? That's prevention rather than risk reduction. By the way, did anybody hear me say that 99% of men are rapists? Did I say that? Okay, good. Thank you. I did not say that. And I ask the question because I know from experience that some men are really defensive about this subject. Not all men, but some men are really defensive. And so they hear things that aren't being said, or they distort things through the lens of their defensive reaction, which I understand. I could be as defensive as the next guy, believe me. But I know that we need to move beyond men's defensiveness if you want to get anywhere in this subject matter. And one of the ways to do that is to be really clear and accurate about what we're saying. So let me just rephrase what I said. Over 99% of rape is perpetrated by men, but most men are not rapists. Those facts can and do coexist. But having said that most men are not rapists, in fact, the vast majority, I hasten to add that I also believe that most men haven't been doing anything like what we need to be doing about the fact that some of us are continuing to rape women, children, and other men. Because you know what a lot of men will say in response to what I have already said here this morning? A lot of men will say, why are you talking to us like this? Why are you talking to me like this? Why do I have to listen to this guy talk like this? Why do I have to read this book or take this course or attend this Take Back the Night rally? This isn't my problem. It's not my issue. I'm a good guy. Yeah, some of those guys need the help. They need the support. They need the accountability. But not me. This isn't my problem. I'm a good guy. Have you heard men say this? All right, I would characterize this as the norm for what men say in our society, including men who claim to care about social justice, who claim to care about injustice and oppression and violence and abuse. When it comes to domestic and sexual violence, it's not my issue. I'm a good guy. Well, you know what? We need to raise the bar a little higher for what it means to be a good guy in the United States, right, in 2010. And saying, I'm not a rapist is not particularly impressive to me, right? Saying, I don't beat my girlfriend is not something guys should be getting high fives for, right? We need a whole lot more from men. What do we need in a nutshell? And this is something that you're going to probably talk about in various ways throughout today, tomorrow. We need more men with the consciousness, with the conscience, with the moral integrity, sometimes with the physical courage to speak up and break our complicit silence and challenge other men's abusive behavior and the attitudes that lead to those abusive behaviors. We need more men who are willing to say, hey, man, you're my friend, but the way you're talking to your girlfriend is not okay, man. It's not okay. I don't appreciate it, and it's not okay with me. We need more men with the guts to say that. And I say guts because one of the reasons why so few men do it is because it does take guts. And I'm not talking just physical courage, because physical courage is a form of courage. I appreciate it. And in some cases, and I'm sure you have stories where people have said, I wouldn't say anything because, you know, say something here, I'm taking a risk that I'm going to get shot or I'm going to get stabbed. And, you know, I appreciate it's complicated sometimes, but the concept here is not complicated. The concept here is silence in the face of violence and abuse and oppression is consent to violence, abuse, and oppression. And there's an awful lot of silence in male culture around these issues. And I think a lot of men used women to speak for us. This is another thing that happens, because a lot of men feel comfortable, oh, finally, somebody said something. Some woman, some girl said something. I don't have to say something. Thank God. You know, right? Because I think a lot of men are uncomfortable with the behavior of some of us. I think a lot of boys and young men are uncomfortable with the behavior of some boys and young men. But they are straitjacketed. They're like, they know that if they say something, they're taking too big a risk. Not just with getting beaten down or something, but with losing status in their peer culture, with not being seen as a real man. I mean, this is all about manhood, isn't it? It's all about how we define manhood. What if we define it like the man who speaks up is the strong man, not the weak man? The guy who challenges his friend's sexist behaviors and attitudes is a strong guy, not a weak guy, right? I mean, it seems obvious to me, but this needs to be said out loud, doesn't it? It doesn't get said out loud very much, and it doesn't get said out loud by enough men who are influential in the lives of young men and boys, right? Finally, in terms of the men's issue concept, one of the problems that I have with calling domestic and sexual violence a women's issue is that it erases the personal experiences of millions and millions and millions of men who have direct personal experience with these issues. And this stuff is intensely personal, domestic and sexual violence and teen relationship abuse, not just for women, but for men as well. And I'll just give you a couple examples of what I mean. You know how many men are in relationships with women who are sexual assault survivors, who are domestic violence survivors, who were sexually harassed, sexually abused as children or as adolescents or as adults? Do you know how many men are in tight, in emotional relationships and romantic relationships, marriages, et cetera, with women with those kinds of experiences and histories? By the way, there's plenty of women who are in heterosexual relationships with men who themselves have trauma in their background, sexual violence, victimization, domestic violence, abuse, harassment, trauma, etc. Okay, I understand and appreciate that. Sometimes both parties in a relationship have these experiences. This is also, of course, true in gay male relationships. It's also true in lesbian relationships. There's an awful lot of abuse that happens in our society and trauma that people experience that they bring to their attempts to connect with each other in intimate relationships, right? I mean, you know how many fathers have daughters who have been raped? There's something like 18 million rape survivors in the United States, estimated, right? That's women, children, and men. Think about all the women in this category of 18 million. And then think of all the men who care about those women. I mean, again, I have several male friends who have daughters who are rape survivors. I can't even imagine how that must feel. I'm a parent, but I don't have this experience. And I, you know, hope, of course, never to have such an experience. But you think about all the men who have already had this experience. In other words, their child is a rape survivor, whether it's a, in this case, female child or male child. Of course, there's lots of mothers in this category, too, but I'm focusing on the fathers and the men. And look at all the young men who have mothers who are rape survivors. Look at all the young men who have mothers who are domestic violence survivors or currently victims, right? There's an awful lot of boys and men who have this stuff deeply personal in our families and our own personal experiences. And in the deviant sexual assault fields over the past generation, we've talked increasingly, as you know, about the effects of these crimes on children, right? All the children who are growing up in homes where their father abuses their mother, where their mother's boyfriend abuses their mother. I mean, on and on, right? Yes, there's some women who are victim, who are perpetrators themselves, who are abusive, yes, to children, yes. But again, I'm focusing on the much larger case. Well, you know, there's a term, and again, people in the field, of course, know this. The term is children who witness, short for children who witness domestic violence. Again, a term that I do not like and do not use. Why? Because if you're a 7-year-old child cowering in the closet as your father is beating up your mother, you are not a witness. You're a victim. You're not watching something happen to somebody else. You're experiencing it happening to yourself. Think about all the children in this category, right? Even as we speak in the state of California and all over, right? Well, the category of children who are being traumatized by what an adult man is doing to their mother, and by the way, in a majority of cases when a man is abusive to a woman and there are children involved, he's also abusive to the children. But as far as I'm concerned, if a man abuses the mother of children, even if he doesn't lay a finger on the children, he's abusing them. Because if you abuse a child's mother, as far as I'm concerned, you're abusing that child. I also believe you abuse a child's father, you're abusing that child. Well, the category of children who are being traumatized by what an adult man is doing to their mother and perhaps themselves is a category that includes not just girls, but also boys, right? Think about all the boys in the category. You think about the juvenile system in the state of California. You have any idea how many of the boys in the juvenile system are in there in part because they externalized the pain that they experienced in their family of origin, and they didn't know of other, they didn't have other routes to take than the traditional route, which is when a boy has been abused, the response, or a man has been abused, the typical gendered response to that abuse is, somebody took something from me, I'm going to take it from somebody else, right? Girls who have been abused, while that does happen sometimes, are more likely to turn inward and abuse themselves. So girls who have been abused are highly much more likely to become self-abusive, cut themselves, hurt themselves, put themselves in situations of greater vulnerability. Is the difference between girls internalizing and boys externalizing, is that a genetic difference? Is there some genetic trigger that goes off in the female versus the male when trauma happens and boys go out and kick ass and girls go in and hurt themselves? I don't think so. It's how we socialize girls differently from how we socialize boys. And one of the things we've been teaching boys for a long, long time is one way to deal with your pain, other than medicating it, you know, is to take it out on somebody else. It's really that not that complicated. In fact, it's very straightforward. And so much antisocial behavior by boys has its origins in the family and their home and in their immediate childhood and adolescent circumstances. So much antisocial behavior by boys and men has its roots close to home. There's no peace on the streets if there's no peace in the home. There's no peace in the community if there's no peace in the family. There's no peace in the world if there's no peace at home. We've got to make these connections. We've got to make these connections on the micro level to the macro level and back. And by the way, if boys who have experienced these issues, you know, experienced violence and then gone out and done the traditional path, which is to take it out on others and act antisocially, if those boys can navigate the challenging waters of childhood and adolescence and emerge into adulthood, then what do we got? We have an awful lot of men in our society who are walking wounded. That's what we got. We have an awful lot of men walking wounded from the traumas of our childhoods. Go to an AA meeting any day and night of the week, right? What are you going to see over and over again, right? Now, there are women at AA meetings. Clearly, women have alcohol and drug addiction problems. But way disproportionately men. And you're going to see a lot of men who have medicated themselves against the effects of these issues. You see men who are isolated. You see men who are walking depressed, whether it's overt or covert depression. It's just incredibly common. We talk about, you know, returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, which is another important issue, to say the least, right? And I'm sure some of you have been in your own work dealing with the effects of U.S. foreign policy right here at home right recently, haven't you? Right? Just like my generation grew up with Vietnam vets disproportionately among the homeless and among the men in Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and drinking and drugging. This generation, it's Iraq and Afghanistan. And there are women, more women, because of more women's participation in the military. But it's not just war veterans who have trauma, right? There's an awful lot of young boys and girls growing up in our communities who have trauma that's in some ways analogous, not always analogous, but some ways analogous to war trauma and in need of services. And by the way, the prison system in the United States, which is a disgrace, both historically and internationally, right, is filled with men. By the way, we say we have more people in prison than any society in the world. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. So we say, you've heard this many times, right? We have the most people in prison in the world. Well, no, we don't have the most people in prison. You want to get real specific? We have the most men in prison because 94% of the people in prison are men. And that's not a coincidence, and it's not a peripheral fact either. It's central. And obviously, if we're going to talk about prisons and the prison industrial complex, we have to talk about racism and we have to talk about poverty. Obviously, those are huge systems that impact who ends up in the prisons, right? Of course. But we also have to talk about violence because a huge number of the men in prison are men who came from violent families and violent circumstances and they didn't know how to do something different than the traditional path, which is what I was talking about already. And I'm not defending bad behavior by men. Let me just be clear about that. If men did things, antisocial behaviors, including violence, I'm not saying that it's okay because they had a bad childhood. No, you don't have to say that, okay, to argue what I'm arguing. People need to be held accountable for their behavior at the same time as we have to understand larger systemic forces that produce these outcomes. It's not one or the other. It's one thing that's been going on in the society for a long time is this debate about, are you going to look at the causes of crime, like the poverty and racism, and are you therefore excusing this bad behavior? No, it's not one or the other. You can do both. And if we want to have systemic change and historical transformation, we have to ask bigger questions about what's going on? Why did so many men do these things, these predictable things? And how is the criminal justice system selective in its decision about who to hold accountable for such things? These are bigger and important questions. Anyways, the point is prisons are absolutely filled with men who are chronologically adults, who have muscles maybe, and maybe they're tough on the outside, but they're little boys underneath. They're little boys. I've worked in prisons. I've worked with adult men in many different contexts. I've worked with a lot of professional athletes who are not in prison. Imagine that quote standing alone. It would make me. It would be the end of my work in professional athletics. I don't care what a guy looks like on the outside. I don't care how tough he looks on the outside. You know how many men are what we used to call cast iron marshmallows? You know how many men look tough guy on the outside and emotionally they're just like little babies? I mean, I work with, for example, a lot of collegiate athletes, a lot of football players, for example. College football players, MVP, we've been working with them with the elite Division I athletic programs for 17 years. Some of these guys are like, think about this, because it's also related in a sense to the teen focus of this conference. 6'6", 290 pounds, 300 pounds. The NFL has 300, the NFL today, by the way, has 565 players over 300 pounds. 565 players over 300 pounds. When I was a kid, 300 pounds was like unbelievably huge. Today it's like normative, okay? That's one change that's been happening over the past. Anyways, these huge guys, okay, they put on shoulder pads and they put on a helmet and it's like gladiatorial and literally larger than life, right? These guys, and we watch them, some of us on TV or in, you know, big stadiums, and these guys look like the epitome of kind of manly prowess, you know? But guess what? A college football player is not a man. He's at best, a young man. He's often a boy. He's an adolescent developmentally. 18 years old, 19 years old, 20 years old. People looking at them, including adult men, looking at them like, these guys are warriors. No, they're not. They are young men and sometimes boys who are playing, quote unquote, a man's game, who are looking tough. Because if you see them off the field, if you talk to their, you know, people who know them, or you talk to them directly, you're going to find all kinds of the same issues that you're going to find with young guys everywhere or young women everywhere, with trying to struggle with their identity, trying to be good people, trying to connect, have relationships, do the right thing, right? But people look to them like they're somehow, you know, already fully formed men, which is ridiculous. And this is also true of the posturing that you see from a lot of men, whether it's in prison or on the streets or in corporate America. There's an awful lot of men who have gotten really good at presenting a kind of front about how much in control they are. But it's just that, a front. And we've got to be honest. And again, that's something that we need more men's leadership on, publicly talking honestly about some of these processes. I'm going to shift gears slightly, and then I've said a lot, so I'm going to open it. I want to give you some space to respond, but I just don't want to forget one piece of the shift in our thinking that we need. Okay, I've been talking about a paradigm shift, essentially, right? A paradigm shift. Instead of seeing domestic and sexual violence as a women's issue that some good men help out with, we have to understand this as a men's issue. And, by the way, and a women's issue. So it's not like a men's issue to the exclusion of women. It's men's and women's. And then, by the way, if people say in response to that, well, why do you have to say men's and women's? Why can't you just say they're community issues? Why can't you say they're just public health issues? They're social justice issues. They're human rights issues, all of which they are. My response to that is that if we want to do what I've been saying we need to do, which is engage more men, using gender-neutral terms like community issues, public health issues, is not going to get men involved. It's just going to, because a lot of men is going to continue to go to the default in our brain, which is community issue, women's issue, human rights, women's issue, you know, social justice, kind of women's concern, right? And we need to say it directly. These are men's issues. Of course, and women's issues. And yes, in addition, they are also community issues, public health issues, social justice issues, et cetera. I mean, I'm speaking from 30 years of experience now. We can go another 30 years and still have conferences on these issues and have, you know, 5% men. Or we can do something different and expect different results. You know, it was Einstein that said, you know, that one of the definitions of insanity was doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So, in addition to this paradigm shift that makes these issues men's issues as well as women's issues, and I think we need to make these issues leadership issues for men. And we need to say that over and over again, okay? What does that mean? These are leadership issues for men? It means that if you're a man in a position of leadership, and however you define that, in your family, in your community, in your faith community, in the business, in labor unions, in community organizations, in education, in sports, in media, whatever. If you're a man who's in a position of leadership, by definition of that leadership, you need to be knowledgeable about these issues, and you need to figure out how you can use your platform of influence to make a difference. Not because you're a nice guy helping out, or because the woman colleague of yours asked you to come to a conference, you come along, you know. Not because a woman has asked you to participate, which is often somehow some men get involved, but because you know that you're expected by both women and men as a leader to be engaged with this stuff. If we got to that point in our society, then we're going to see a very quick and dramatic shift, okay? And I'll just give you an example. It's from a subject close to my experience, and I referenced it already, sports, right? The sports culture. If there's a program in college athletics today in the United States, it's an athletic program that does not have mandated sexual and domestic violence relationship abuse prevention education as part of the experience for all the student-athletes, that's male student-athletes, female student-athletes. If there is any college or university that does not have routine and regular expected domestic and sexual violence prevention education for all the student-athletes and coaches and, you know, and staff, There's no excuse for it. No excuse for it. None. There's no excuse. But where does the accountability go? Does it go to the student athletes? Does it go to the coaches? No. It goes to the athletic director, right? Because the athletic director, if an athletic director, and something close to 90% of athletic directors at Division I colleges are men, over 90% of Division I colleges are men, okay? There are women. If an athletic director at a college or university says, we're going to have domestic and sexual violence prevention education for all student athletes here, guess what happens? There is domestic and sexual violence prevention education for all the student athletes. That's what happens, right? If there are coaches who say, you know what, I'm not really on board with all this. This is too much, and our student athletes are already expected to do too much, and I'm not really in favor of this. The athletic director hires the coaches, right? Now, some coaches, there are plenty of great coaches who understand their role to be more than just winning games or matches. There's coaches who understand they are mentors, they're teachers, they're leaders, in addition to being, on the field or on the ice or on the court leaders. But there are coaches who are not on board with all that, and there are coaches who act in their own way as coaches in ways that are problematic and contribute to the problem in the first place. I appreciate all of that. But if a coach wants to or doesn't want to participate in this, it doesn't matter. The athletic director says, we're going to do it. And over time, coaches who are not supportive become outliers in the culture, if you will, because the athletic director kind of sets the culture by the hiring of the coaches. And ultimately, there's going to be peer pressure on coaches to get on board in this system if they want to make it in that program. That's how one of the ways the systems works, right? If the student athletes say, come on, why do we have to go? Why are we being singled out as student athletes? Why don't other kids have to go? Why are athletes always being picked on? Some of the predictable things you're going to hear from some men, perhaps some women, about participation in such events or education. If the coach says, be in room 222 in Wilson Hall Tuesday night for the next 6 weeks because this stuff is important and we are an important part of this campus community and we are going to be part of this and be there and you're going to get a lot out of this, it doesn't matter what the student athletes think. They are walking through the door of room 222 at 7:30 in Wilson Hall for the next 6 weeks. And if those of us who do our job, and we do our job well, all of us, most of us, they're not going to walk out. If they walked in with their hands folded, why do we have to be here? They're not going to walk out like that. They're going to walk out like, wow, this was interesting. I didn't really know it was going to get, this is going to really interesting, which is what happens in a lot of domestic and sexual violence and relationship abuse education, right? A lot of real interesting stuff happens, but you got to get them in the door first. And the way that happens, it goes back to the athletic director. And by the way, if the athletic director is not responsive, and I've heard a whole range, okay, athletic directors who are really work closely with domestic and sexual violence prevention people and are really good on that, and others who don't even return the emails of sexual assault people on campuses. If the athletic director is not responsive, then we need to figure out who hires the athletic director, right? And who hires, who in the administration chain of command, if you will, hires the athletic director, and how can we put pressure on that person? This is democracy 101, right? If we say in our communities that we have a priority to deal with these issues, right? We have a priority to deal with these issues. Then we want to expect that the leaders in these institutions are going to address them. And if they're not addressing them, the leaders, then we have to say, we have to pressure them to address them. And if they don't want to address them, then we have to find new leaders, right? This is what democracy is about, isn't it? As opposed to passively saying, oh, it's too bad our people in control here aren't really addressing these issues. It's like we need to be active. We need to be empowered, and we need to act like citizens in a democratic society, even if sometimes that's a bit of a stretch. Because if leaders start taking on these stuff, if it becomes obvious that young men and young women who are going through the pipeline, if you will, towards leadership, whether it's in college, taking classes, and into graduate school, etc., if they know that it's going to be expected of them in positions of, when they take positions of leadership, that they are going to have to be knowledgeable and address some of this stuff, then they're going to start, because of this, their own self-interest, they're going to start taking the classes, they're going to start participating in programs, because they know that ultimately they're going to be, their success is dependent upon it. And I deal with this in a whole number of different realms, not just athletic leadership, religious leaders. You know how many men are religious leaders who don't know what the hell they're talking about? Pardon me. when it comes to domestic and sexual violence. You know how many men claim to be moral leaders who don't have the guts to say from the podium that domestic and sexual violence are wrong and you know, in the most basic ways? It's like a private matter. It's a private matter. We'll talk about it in the privacy of our, you know, of our counseling capacity. Right? Come on. And you know, one of the benefits, and I've been working in the military with the U.S. military for 13 years. One of the benefits of working in the military is that it is a hierarchically organized institution, which means that when decisions get made at the top, again, with input, it has to be. It's a complex institutional setting, but when decisions get made at the top, they can filter down much more quickly. You understand? When they get made at the bottom, this is what has been happening over the past generation is that they're women mostly. Civilian and military, some men at the bottom levels of power in the DOD, Department of Defense, who have tried to make changes and everything else, but they bump up against the limitations of their leadership within the institution, and they don't have the power, they don't have the money, they don't have the resources. They can't just say, we're going to have a stand-down day on this base until we deal with these issues. They can't, because they don't have the power. So they pressure upward, and then the suits, you know, and the flag officers and the generals and the admirals can either say, this is important, or they can say, you know, thank you very much. You can have your room over there, and you can have a little, you know, seminar over here. Imagine if the admirals and the generals were the ones who were saying, we need to address this. And that's beginning to happen. It is beginning to happen. In part because of congressional pressure, in part because of the shame and embarrassment of women service members being raped by male service members in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as stateside, and congressional pressure, civilian pressure on the military to address these issues. But this is an issue for the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, and all the admirals and generals. And imagine how quickly things can change if the leadership was coming explicitly from that level rather than from the bottom, you know, so on and on. So leadership, and one last thing, and then I'll open it up for questions and comments. High schools. So how many high school students are in the room? Just curious. Thank you for being here and for your leadership for being here. High school principals have enormous platform of leadership. And now a lot of men who are principals, which is over 50% still, are high school principals are men. There are plenty of women principals. A lot of high school men principals have seen their responsibility, if anything, on these issues, is to delegate authority to women in the school to deal with this. So Ms. Jones, the assistant principal, or the guidance counselor, Ms. Smith, et cetera, she's really passionate about this subject, and I'm going to, you know, I'll let her deal with the local domestic violence people and whatever that she's going to do. As opposed to saying, you know what, I, as a man, am the principal of this high school, and I have an enormous platform of leadership here, and I'm going to use my platform, visible member of the community as well, to do whatever I can. I'm going to figure out if there's, within collective bargaining, you know, agreements, I'm going to get training for all my staff, all my, you know, faculty and staff. I'm gonna have school assemblies where it's not gonna just be women talking, it's gonna be men. I'm gonna have myself, and I'm gonna invite other men in to speak. I'm gonna have men and women working together because we need to show boys and girls that men and women work together on this stuff. Anyways, there's so much that men could do if we just said it's gonna be our issue, and we're not gonna just defer always to women's leadership, or I should say, evade our responsibility by delegating in some cases to women's leadership. There's so much more that we could be doing in creating that climate in these schools, on sports teams, in religious communities, in the faith, you know, it's so many different places. If more men in positions of leadership were to take this on as a priority. So these are all paradigm shifts. And lastly, this is just one quick point. Working with one of the best ways to work with boys on the issues of teen dating violence or sexual assault or other issues is to work with men and women who work with boys. So, in other words, it's not just about the micro delivery of the message to the boys themselves. It's like, think about, for example, the juvenile justice system, which I'm passionate about. I used to work in my 20s as a counselor in a detention center in Boston, right? in my 20s with young men, boys. Think about all the staff members who work with boys on a daily basis. They spend huge amounts of time with boys who are locked up for various crimes, right? Think about the men and women on the staffs of the various programs, whether they're big institutional lockups or they're community programs. There's almost no training on these issues for the staffs who work sometimes 16 hours, 7 in the morning till 11 at night, until the kids, or 10 at night or whatever, until the lights go out. They're with these kids all day long. And yet, have they had any training on this subject, on connecting sexual and domestic violence with, and gang violence and all the interconnections between all these phenomena? Have they had any exposure to media literacy and media thinking critically about how media helps to shape social norms? You got guys in programs watching pro wrestling with the boys who are locked up for violent crimes. They're sitting there watching pro wrestling on TV, you know, as if like there's no problem there. You know what I mean? As if what they're learning in the media isn't somehow influencing who they are and what they think men are supposed to act like. It's so naive. Anyways, the point is, we need training for these people. So working with men and women who work with boys is one of the ways to work with boys. And parents. I mean, obviously parents need support, help, ideas, empathy. So we have a lot of work to do, don't we? But I'm going to, for this portion, I'm going to stop. I want to give you some opportunity to ask questions, respond to anything that I've said or not said before we go to the last portion, which is media. So does anybody want to?
Okay, I'm asked a lot of times to present to men's groups. My question as a woman is talking to men, as a woman, to men about that it's a men's issue.
Well, let me ask you, what's your strategy to
date? Well, I just got done speaking to a men's group, and I wasn't as blunt as you were, but I'm trying to engage them.
Right.
And what I basically got was, that was a really nice presentation, sweetie. We really loved it. And it was extremely frustrating because I was asked to speak at that group. I'm presenting to young men. I have young men in my group. We're dealing with these issues, and that's a pat on the back, and what a nice young woman that was. And I'm going to be speaking to, that was the AM group, and I'm going to be speaking to the PM group in August. And so obviously I have to take some other kind of bend, and they're 95% men, leaders in our community.
Okay.
So I come off as either, that was, you know, that's a nice girl and pat her on the back, she's got a great little program, or I can take a different bend and it's, who is that gal that's trying to come down our back and tell us what to do?
Thank you. I hear you. And a couple things. One is, I'm sure that you've been effective, even beyond what you can measure by the visible response. So, for example, in a setting like that, and I don't know exactly what it looks like, but a setting like that, if a woman is presenting and there are mostly men, and is it all men and you're the only woman? Or are there women? Okay. Okay. There are things that you're going to say that a lot of men are going to be nodding to themselves, but not necessarily feel strong enough to publicly support what you're saying in front of their male peers, right? Because like, as I was saying earlier, there's a lot of silence in male culture, not because guys are agreeing with some of the abusive behavior or approving it consciously. It's just that they're too scared to say anything because they don't want to lose approval, peer support, status in their peer culture. And it's not just 16-year-old boys. It's another thing. I mean, I'm sure people know this, but I'll say it out loud. Peer pressure does not stop at age 16 or 17. Adult men have peer pressure. Adult men, 50-year-old men have peer pressure. They care about we care about what our peers think of us. You know what I'm saying? Not just 16-year-old boys. And the amazing thing is how similar some of the peer pressure is for 55-year-olds as it is for 17-year-olds. Amazing. So what I'm saying is I think that a lot of those men probably heard what you were saying and probably thinking to themselves, that makes a lot of sense, but they weren't necessarily going to say, Go for it, Elizabeth. You know, you're telling the truth. That's one thing. Another thing is, you could, if you didn't already, you can refer to a lot of work that's been going on all over the world and in the States right here among men, and you could point to it, and you could say, in the talks, I'm saying, you could say, look, I'm not just saying this here. I'm saying you could quote generals in the United States Army, you know, who are saying stuff that supports this. If you want to do the research, I mean, go on, you know, Google it or contact some of us. We can give you some support for this. And then they're arguing with, you know, the Marine Corps general. You know, they're arguing with the iconic football coach that they think is somebody who's worthy of respect. That's one way to do it too, because it's not just prospectively we want to get men involved. We already have men involved. I mean, we have nowhere near the critical mass that we need. I'm not suggesting that we do, but we have a lot more today than we did 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Do you know what I'm saying? So there's ways to support what you're saying by quoting others, by talking about different initiatives, coaching boys into men, for example. You know, which is some of the people are going to be here at this conference, based in the Family Violence Prevention Fund in San Francisco. Coaching boys into men is engaged with trying to figure out ways to get coaches at all levels to use their platform of leadership to talk about this. So there's ways you can support what you're saying with ongoing initiatives that already exist, and you can reference them. And I also would say use the word leadership every third or fourth word in your talk, and say one of the reasons why there has been such little participation among men, relatively speaking, on these issues is because it takes courage and strength and leadership. Because I would say talk openly. This is, again, you could do what you, I'm just giving you suggestions, because it's a difficult situation you're in. I appreciate that. I can be more blunt, and I am more blunt, and other men too. We can cut right through certain stuff because we don't have to deal with the sexism that delegitimizes what we're saying. I deal with other issues. It's not, you know, maybe it's not the sexism, but it's other issues that people try to discredit the speaker. It's an old, you know, it's an old story, right? Killing the messenger. You know, killing the young people in the room know what killing the messenger means? You know, the saying, killing the messenger? You know where it comes from? It comes from ancient times, right? Before the internet. And it was like in the, you know, ancient Rome or something. They didn't have they didn't have telephones or telegraph machines or anything. And so if the emperor decided that they were going to stop attacking some, you know, poor peasant community, how is the emperor going to communicate that to the general in the field? They have a messenger by foot or by horseback, would go, you know, 400 miles or whatever to deliver the message. Now, if the general wanted to keep fighting the war or continue the slaughter, what would he do? You just kill the messenger. And all of a sudden, you have two more weeks of mayhem. You know what I'm saying? So killing the messenger is a tried and true method of not dealing with what the person is saying that you don't like to hear. And so that's one of the things that women deal with in this work all the time. She's just angry, she's just ugly, she just hates men. You know, on and on, as a way of delegitimizing what the woman is saying. And so when men do it, we have other issues. Again, there's other ways to delegitimize us, but that's not one of them. And that's one of the privileges we have as men. So I appreciate you're in a tough spot. But I do think there are supports for what you're saying. One other last thing, one strategy you might employ, might not, but might, is if you have a way to talk to some of the men in the room before you get on stage, if you will, and you take them aside and say, look, I'm going to be saying some things that are kind of challenging, and some of the guys in this room are going to be challenged by some of the things that I say. It would be really great if you could, if you agree with what I'm saying, if you could say it publicly and just, you know, support what I'm saying, because it's really hard being in my position. Some guys, if they're up for that, we'll take that on. And I think that's true with boys as well, young men in high schools. If you're a teacher, if you're an educator, a youth leader, whatever, and you're going to be addressing an issue with a group of boys, even a mixed-gender classroom, but if you can figure out a way to take one of those boys aside, and maybe it's Monday, and you're going to be raising this issue on Friday, and it's not like 2 seconds before you go on, you know, before you go into the classroom, but you say, look, there's some issues that I think are really important for us to deal with, but some of your fellow boys might not be really comfortable with this, and they're going to act out, they're going to give me a hard time. It would be really great if you agree with what I'm saying, to you, for you to participate and speak up. And a lot of young guys have never been approached in that way. Because you're basically saying to them, you see some leadership qualities in them. You see some positive qualities in them, and you're hoping that they can evidence those qualities in support of you in your work, you know, that kind of thing.
The challenges that we have is not necessarily working with men in groups, but working with men in key leadership positions. Most recently, we had an issue with our district attorney and his chief investigator. And trying to affect change in the way they think and the way they approach not just cases, but those of us who are doing this work. Most recently, we've heard things like, they just don't know their place. They're overstepping their bounds about the work that we're doing. And it's a huge challenge when you've got a person in a leadership role who doesn't have any peers within the county that has those not just beliefs, but it feels comfortable verbalizing those beliefs. And how do you even address that? How do you even have a conversation when you know those are the core beliefs that person has?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, the first thing I think of is, you've already partially addressed it, which is, what are the systems of accountability that you can call on? So, for example, if it's an elected official, if it's an appointed official, if that person relies upon certain, there is some kind of a chain of accountability, whatever point on that chain of accountability that you can influence, then I would say that that's where you have to go. If in other words, if any other form of encouragement, cajoling, you know, whatever, requests is not getting you anywhere or getting you where you need to go, then the question becomes, like I said, about, okay, how is this person going to be held accountable for not changing? And then, and in some cases, there are forms of accountability. In other cases, it's, you know, you just got to keep fighting, if you will, or struggling. To the extent that it's, I mean, I don't know the specifics, obviously. And I would never say, I never tell people, this is what you need to do. Because especially women dealing with men who are in positions of power and recalcitrant on various issues, you have to make decisions. Women make them all the time, right? Is it worth fighting this fight? Is it worth getting this guy pissed off at me? And then he's got funding, you know, sources. He's got all kinds of other ways. Materially, he's going to make my life and the life of the people that I work with and for difficult if I challenge him at this level. I appreciate that. So I think women are making these decisions all the time to, like, okay, I'm not going to say this. I'm not going to challenge this guy. I'm not, because it's not going to, you know, redound favorably to what I need to accomplish. And I appreciate that. And I'm in a position, and other men, not all men, but other men are in a position where I can, you know, say certain things that you probably can't say. And, you know, I leave later, you know, today. I get on a plane kind of thing. If I'm in a community somewhere, I'm leaving the next day. And the women there have to leave, you know, on a day-to-day basis, have to work with these men. But I think we need to enlarge the conversation and try to figure out, are there any male allies that you can call on? And by the way, there's a learning curve for a lot of men. I mean, a lot of men just don't know anything about these issues. They're good men, they're good people, but they don't know anything. So I think some of these men need to be educated. They need to read articles. You need to hand them articles and say, look, I'm talking about potential male allies who could help you challenge those men in power. We can't just expect, for example, that middle-aged men or even younger men have a working understanding of the issues in the way that we do, right? Our goal, our role in part is to educate them, isn't it? Sorry if that's not the magic answer. Yes.
Well, as a youth, like, when we go talk to, like, high schools and stuff, like, and because we're young females at that, a lot of younger boys, like, really don't want to hear nothing we say. And so I feel like how another lady said that she don't really have no authority over the men, basically. So how would I reach out, like, to younger people, like, younger men?
Good question.
Because I feel like if I was to go up there and say the same exact thing that you said, like, they'd just disregard everything I said. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But since you're a male, like, they would really understand you better. So how would I reach out?
Okay, well, thanks for asking the question. No, seriously. That takes guts to stand up in a microphone and ask a question. So thank you. One of the things you have to decide is what you want to accomplish, right? In any social justice advocacy or political struggle, you have to figure out what do you want to accomplish, right? What is your goal? And think about your goal realistically, but optimistically. Like, you know, you have a vision for the best case scenario, but also what can you practically accomplish? So when you figure out what you want to accomplish, the route there becomes a little more clear, right? So for example, if you want to raise awareness in your school, you're talking about a school setting, right?
Yeah.
If you want to raise awareness, then you raise awareness. There's a number of different ways to do it. And people could say, that's bullshit. It doesn't, you're still raising awareness. You know what I'm saying? You're not going to necessarily get people running up to you and thanking you. Well, this is so great what you're doing. But you're still having an effect on raising their awareness if the goal is raising awareness. If you want the young women to know that there are services available to them, that they don't have to live in abusive relationships because it's wrong to do that, and there are services available for victims and survivors, and that's your goal, then you proceed accordingly. In other words, you don't have to do everything. You don't have to achieve everything. And in every conversation or every presentation or every engagement, you're not going to achieve all of your intended outcomes. But if you have a clear picture of what you want to accomplish, then you can target it. Some boys hear things you're saying even though they wouldn't admit it, because they're not going to admit it to their boys when you're talking to them that what you're saying makes a lot of sense. Yeah. If by agreeing with you, they're going to lose status in their peer culture, right? One thing I also didn't talk about, and I can only say this for a second because of time constraints, is, you know, the bystander approach. Right, which is, I'm one of the, you know, architects of this whole approach, right? The bystander approach to gender violence prevention. The focus is on men and boys, not as perpetrators or potential perpetrators of abuse, but as friends and as teammates and as classmates and as co-workers. The focus on girls and women is not on girls and women as victims or potential victims or targets of harassment or abuse, but as friends, teammates, classmates, co-workers. In other words, girls, boys and girls, men and women who are not themselves directly involved in either perpetrating or experiencing abuse, but who are embedded in peer cultures with others. If you focus on the bystander, you're taking away the defensiveness of boys or men, right? Because you're saying, look, your guy who's acting out in this way, he needs you to challenge him. He needs you to support him, because if he continues acting this way, he's going to end up in jail. He's going to end up in big trouble. And if he's your friend, you have a responsibility to him. If you're talking to men like this as bystanders, then you're going to get less defensive reaction. You follow me? This is, by the way, social justice 101. It's like if you're a white person and you yourself don't act out in racist ways, but you don't challenge other white people who are acting out in racist ways, then in a sense, isn't your silence a form of consent and complicity? By saying to white people, look, we need to speak up to challenge each other, it's different from saying you are a racist and you better stop being a racist. It's like you need to speak up and challenge, you know. And it's the same with heterosexism, on and on and on. So that's one potential way. And always thinking about a person's self-interest, not just their altruistic concern for others, but think about their self-interest. So, for example, if you have guys in that room who care about their guy friends, right? And you can say, look, if you care about this guy and you see him acting this way, by definition of your concern for him, you need to challenge him. You need to speak, not just because of the girl that he's hurting, although that's important too, but because of himself, because he's going to be hurting himself and hurting the people who care about him. And if you're his friend, then you need to say something to him, you know, that kind of thing. I think these are angles in that people can, especially men, can hear better than direct challenges to their own personal behavior. Does anybody else? Okay, well, how about one last one, and then we'll go to the whirlwind media literacy tour, please.
You were just inviting men to kind of, you know, do some work. So in that vein, don't kill the messenger. And and what I wanted to put out is that, so there was an awkward, uncomfortable silence when you said, you know, when we talk about racism, we don't expect that, you know, it's equal, right? Same awkward silence that's happening now. So in that vein, one of the things that I was really struck by is that what you're encouraging us to think about is a set of strategies that think about how do we use our influence in structures that already exist to essentially create the justice or the, you know, the outcomes that we want. From my point of view, I've been part of and have learned so much from communities that are so far oppressed and marginalized out of those systems that that's a joke. And it's a joke in the most cruel way because it's saying specifically these systems that are organized to exclude you, keep you out, and that are not democratic by both nature and by design are the very institutions which you now have to organize all of your love, energy, and like direction into changing, and then through your efforts and energies, you're making the system more valid, right? Like I think about UC Berkeley. I happen to go to university there. And when I went there, it's a place that people kind of associate with resistance and democracy, but it's also a place with really jacked up politics from the administration down to the students, if folks haven't been noticing recently. And so it's like our resistance is then co-opted as a way of saying, look at how legitimate our democracy is, that it's there's space for you to be brutalized by the police and to then be co-opted and said, hey, we live in a democratic society. And specifically, the thing that I'm kind of interested in is that in our field, in our work, we keep looking up. And we've come to the point where we believe this very, I think, privileged position that systems will change if only we put enough pressure on them. And we've not done enough work about teaching each other about how people have built power with one another, like lessons from Venezuela, lessons from Ecuador, lessons from throughout Africa. It's like, what about that? Because we keep talking about, like, if you only influence the person above the influencer you're trying to get to, that'll work. And I'm like, really? Really? So that's my question. Okay. Good luck.
Thank you very much. No, I appreciate the question. I'm trying to think. It's a huge subject that you raise, and I appreciate it. I'm trying to think how to answer it in an adequate way, knowing that Nancy's about to give me the time. This is a big question about, you know, reform versus revolution. Is it how do you create new social forms and economic and political structures? And one of the things, and I believe me, I understand and appreciate the need for, you know, visionary social change that transforms the very nature of the institutions that we're working with, not just puts pressure on individuals who are running those institutions as they're currently constituted. I understand and appreciate this is a big question, right? I mean, I think also people need to have a vision for how something could be constructed, or how a society and social relations in that society can be constructed differently than the one that we have. But I also feel the need that people have to have something they can hold on to. They can't walk out of a room and think, oh my God, you know, there's nothing really we can do unless we totally transform the system, because people are overwhelmed by that, overwhelmed by the idea that we need to transform the whole system. So within the existing institutional structures, what can we do to, this is what I would come down with, is within the existing institutional structures, how can we make them more democratic? How can we use democratic forms of participation to make them more democratic, knowing that that might not be ultimately where we have to go to transform the world in the way that I'm assuming you need, you know, you want the world transformed, or I want the world transformed, because I think we can do a whole lot more in the current system than we have been doing in terms of democratic participation, holding people accountable, changing, you know, and especially when it comes to rates of violence, we can reduce rates of violence dramatically within the existing structures if we have better leadership, better democratic participation. But I appreciate that it's a bigger conversation that you raise.
I'm just going to kind of piggyback off of his comment, because I too completely understand, coming from a society and a culture where people are so oppressed and so marginalized, how do you even begin to talk about things like this, because it's not real? It's not uncommon that in Pakistan, you know, where my family is from, in the villages, in the rural areas, it's not uncommon that if a girl goes to report a rape, she'll be gang raped by the police officers to in turn shut her up again. And so when you're talking about how do you even bring this up to people who don't know, you know, what democracy is and things like that, well, I think that this right here is so great, you know, where you have a like-minded academic individuals discussing the discourse, talking about it, agreeing on it. If you want to talk about a grassroots effort in places like, you know, Darfur, in Pakistan, in India, all over, it's not so much about getting, like, a like-minded people together or like-minded thinking people together. It's more about getting to the people themselves, getting to the villagers, getting to the citizens, getting to the boys and the girls and the women and the men and the families all over. Because you're going to be looking at, like, going back to Pakistan for an example, if you're looking at the stoning of a woman or the gang rape of girls and things like that, it's not so much men who are cheering that on, it's girls. It's women cheering that on because they too believe, oh, well, that's what you get. You know, you deserve that. And so kind of getting back to this, you know, this kind of like grassroots effort, it's about changing that mentality. It's about teaching women not to victimize other women as much as other men are victimizing women and men themselves. So I come from the same culture, so that's what I thought.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is great. I mean, I wish we could go on and on. I appreciate that, and it's a real world, you know, kind of dose of, you know, sobriety, if you will. Let me just say, in wrapping up, this is totally inadequate for the complexity of some of the issues that you've all just raised. I'm going to give you like just a 2 minutes of a media literacy thing because I feel like I promised it, and I don't want to completely abrogate my promise. But to me, gender equality is fundamental to any social justice struggle, whether it's in Pakistan or in the United States, and that's my position. I know it's complicated how you make that happen, but I think that any struggle worth struggling for has to include equality between the sexes. And within communities that are dispossessed, if they're reproducing some of the larger communities' inequalities while they're struggling against the larger inequality that they see, then that's a problem too. And that we said that in this country right here, we have social justice movements that reproduce sexism and racism while they're struggling for other forms of justice and equality. And I would just make a strong sort of advocacy for, in particular, when men are involved in social justice struggles, if they are not also struggling with sexism, both their own participation in it and the larger system, then it's a partial struggle for liberation at best. That's what I would say. Whether it's in, you know, developing world and all kinds of, you know, desperate situations, or in the wealthy world here in the United States. And I think that's been left out a lot of social justice movements, is gender equality being fundamental. And what you're talking about, women, you know, holding other women accountable, that's an old story. And that's colonization of minds, it's co-optation of resistance, and it, you know, we deal with this on a continuum, right? Constantly. But I think both men and women need to be struggling with the question of gender equality and how we can achieve it. Last point here is media literacy. I'm rushing here. But media literacy, this is a pitch for the incredibly important and this, you know, necessary role that critical media literacy needs to play in our work. And why do I say that? And some of you have probably seen my films, or Byron Hertz, my friend and colleague's film, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. There's a lot of really great stuff out there that's being produced. We're making Tough Guys 2 right now, in fact. So Tough Guys 2 is going to be brand new. And anyways, it's not because media causes violence that we need to study media and we need to engage media. It's because media is the great social norming force of our time. So if we want to change the social norms that produce abusive men and boys, and to a lesser extent girls and women, we need to understand how those social norms are being produced. And so one of the ways to do that, I mean, media is one of those critical places. So it's not a direct causal relationship, like media causes this guy, you know, he's listening to Black Sabbath lyrics and he goes out and kills somebody, you know. That's so stupid, okay? That's not what thoughtful media literacy and critical media, you know, intellectuals would say. It's rather, it's this question of social norms. And so bringing the media itself into the conversation, it needs to be part of the struggle, as far as I'm concerned, and part of the educational practice. And so for the 2 minutes that I have, I'm just going to show you, you know, a couple of slides. These are just, you know, slides. But there's lots more resources where this comes from. And, you know, the Media Education Foundation that produces and distributes my videos, mediaed.org, M-E-D-I-A-E-D, mediaed.org. If you're interested, you should go there, go to their website. Look at, for instance, there's a resource section that gives you all kinds of resources, handouts that you can print out, you know, free stuff. My film, Tough Guys, and Byron Hertz's film, and Gene Kilbourne's films, they're all on there, and there's free study guides on there, free study guides. You can just print them out. If you want to accompany the presentation of the film, you can use these study guides. There's transcripts of the films available for free. This is all on the website. And my website, Jackson Katz, my name, jacksonkatz.com. Just myname.com. You can go there and you can click on the names of my videos, and that'll bring you to the Media Education Foundation website. So, by way of just a teaser about how powerful media is to look at itself, I mean, to be part of the discourse, I had put this slide lecture together. I'm not going to get through it, but I just gave you a handful of slides. It's about boys, this, and men, if you will. And let me just say up front, I love boys and men. My son is a boy. And the reason why I say that is because it's not criticizing boys and criticizing men to critically examine how the culture is limiting what we think of when we say a man. What is a man supposed to be? That's not anti-male. That's pro-male, in fact, right? And it's so maddening. So many women and men who criticize abusive behavior by men get accused of being anti-male, which is such ridiculousness. And it's silencing. It's trying to silence women and men from trying to challenge the cultural definitions of manhood that are so, in so many cases, so problematic. But anyway, so I think it's important to acknowledge, yeah, there's lots of, you know, boys are every bit as loving as girls. Little boys who are born are every bit as full of compassion and life energy as little girls are. What happens? Is it the boy's responsibility? No, it's not the boy's responsibility. What happens in our culture? It's our responsibility. And then the more power we have, the more responsibility we have. This is from a series of slides that's headlined, Why Boys Need Parents. And again, here the premise, I think the visual makes the powerful statement. Boys, as well as girls, need guidance, they need education, they need, you know, they need so much that we need to be giving them, not just within families, because the education that happens and the teaching that happens is not just within families, it's a culture. It's a whole culture that we need. We're raising our sons and daughters as a culture. Harry Potter, there's lots of ways to critique Harry Potter. There's lots of interesting debates about Harry Potter and the whole phenomenon, but it's a huge phenomenon. One of the things, positive things I think about Harry Potter is that it has in the central sort of core of the three, they have friendship between the boys and girls. Hermione and I know Ron is, you know, changes a little bit later, but the central friendship between boys and girls. This is one of the great things that's been happening over the past generation. We have more non-sexual friendships between boys and girls, and partnerships, whether it's in the in young children or in middle school, in high school, in the workplace now, because this has been ongoing for decades now. You have men and women, boys and girls, interacting non-sexually in ways that are, in our culture, unprecedented historically, and it's a very positive development and needs to be, I think, acknowledged. We live in the age of the introspective superhero. One thing that you see over and over again now is that superheroes are no longer. And again, there's more complicated analysis here, but superheroes are no longer just two-dimensional objects. There's lots of ways in which in the media culture that we live in, the superhero has been deconstructed somewhat. In other words, there are issues. These guys have issues. These guys have pathologies. They're not just heroic, can get anything accomplished. They also have stuff going on in the backstory. So, for example, with Tony Soprano, and how many people here know the Sopranos? Okay. So this is just one example, again, of a larger cultural debate about the Sopranos. Tony Soprano plays, James Gandolfini plays the role of Tony Soprano, who's a mob boss in northern New Jersey, and he's a brutally sociopathic, violent murderer, and he's a mob boss, right? And yet he's in therapy, and every week in the show on HBO, he was in a therapy session with his female therapist. Now, that has been critiqued too. The representation of the therapy relationship has been critiqued. But the idea was, that I think is very interesting, was that Tony Soprano is a man in this, the character, is a man with all kinds of problems. He has panic attacks. He had all kinds of issues with his mother. He was not a healthy man. But when publicly he would be in his peer culture walking into strip clubs and with his, he was like, badass fucking Tony Soprano, right? But in reality, this is a guy with all kinds of problems. Now, that doesn't mediate or mitigate his sociopathic, violent, abusive behavior, because he did engage in that. But I'm saying it wasn't just presented as he's just like a healthy guy who's just a tough guy. It's like some of what he was playing out in his abusive behavior was his personal stuff, if you will. Jimmy Neutron, my 8-year-old son, I asked him, because he likes Jimmy Neutron, I said, how would you describe Jimmy Neutron? And he said, he's a technical superhero, which meant, he meant technological, I think, superhero, and which is an interesting, I thought, way to describe it. So in other words, Jimmy Neutron tries to save the world with his brain, not just kicking butt. And I think we need to be encouraging, obviously, young men as well as young women to think of ways to be constructively engaging the world without violence, especially boys. And there's increasing sexual objectification of men. It's nowhere near the sexual objectification of women. I wouldn't make that comparison. But there is an increasing pressure on boys and men to look a certain way and to be have a certain, physical stature. And by the way, the vast majority of men can't meet that standard. And there's lots of anxiety in male culture about not being able to measure up. And that's 15-year-old boys and 55-year-old men. I'm not talking about just boys, but that's something that's unspoken about how so many men in various subcultural groups in the larger culture are always striving after this ideal of what it means to be a man, and nobody is ever there. Nobody ever achieves it. Because even the men who have quote-unquote achieved it, if they're honest, will tell you how anxious they are. And I'm telling you this from decades of experience working with men in places where you can get men to be more honest, create a context for an honest dialogue. So some of the men that I work with who look outwardly like, this guy's got it going on, if you actually get one layer beneath that posing, they get all kinds of anxieties, believe you me. So let's not pretend that there's somehow a man or young men or older men who have somehow got it figured out, because that's fiction. How many interviews have you ever heard with 50 Cent, or reviews of 50 Cent's music, or read, interviews or articles about 50 Cent that do not mention that he has 9 gunshot wounds, right? It's the commodification of the black male body and the identification of black manhood with violent perpetration and victimization as the arbiter or as the epitome of manhood for black men. So many problems with that on so many different levels. And I'm sure many of you have had these discourses in this conversation. And if you haven't seen Byron Hurt's film, Beyond Beats and Rhymes, how many people have? Okay, if you haven't seen it, you should definitely see Beyond Beats and Rhymes. It's a hip-hop : Beyond Beats and Rhymes. Byron Hurt. If you're interested, behurt.com, BHURT.com. It's a brilliant film about black manhood and hypermasculinity, heterosexism, misogyny in rap and hip-hop, and Byron's a hip-hop head from New York way back. It's a really important film. It's easy to see when we look at other cultures far away that socialization practices and how powerful they are. For example, we can look and see other cultures around the world and say that, look, did that boy ever have a choice about who he is or how he's going to enact his manhood? Do other boys, but in our culture, this is right here close to home, this is true. It's easier when you're looking at another culture to see it, but people will say, oh yeah, here, there's freedom of choice. People can do whatever they want. It's like, I'm sorry, that's such an ignorant way to think. There's so many pressures on boys in our culture, in various subcultural settings, in terms of what their life choices are and how their manhood can be enacted and the role of violence in that. How can we have a conversation about gun violence in the United States and not have a conversation about manhood? Yet the conversation about gun violence takes place all the time in the United States and no discussion about manhood. It's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Does anybody know what percentage of gun violence in the U.S. is perpetrated by women? It's less than 10%. Okay, so over 90% of gun violence is perpetrated by men and boys, yet the conversation about gun violence, no discussion about gender. Did anybody here see Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore's Oscar-winning documentary about gun violence in America? Okay, it's a 2-hour film, about gun violence. He won an Oscar for Best Documentary in 2003. He got a 14-minute standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival. Not one mention in 2 hours of the single most important factor in gun violence, which is the gender of the perpetrator. Not one mention in 2-hour film about gun violence. Can you imagine if 90%+ of gun violence was done by women? Anybody making a 2-hour film about gun violence and not even mentioning that women were 90% of the perpetrators and then having a conversation about why that might be? Remember I said earlier we need to make visible what has been rendered invisible? I bet you a lot of people in this room saw Bowling for Columbine and didn't even think of what I just said, right? Because it's just like, oh. It's amazing, isn't it? The first thing we need to talk about gun violence is the gender of the perpetrator. I mean, if we want to talk about the cultural overlay here. Again, the argument among serious people is not that video games or media consumption causes violence. It is the normalization of abuse and violence. It is the desensitization that attaches to it, not the imitation of it. It's the desensitization and normalization that we need to be focused on. This is from a Swedish sculptor. It's in front of the United Nations. They've made copies of it in different parts of the world. It's a powerful message. There are better ways that we can be raising our sons. There are better ways that we can teach them how to be a man that don't involve violence. And by the way, being nonviolent and challenging violence is not unmanly. It's not wimpy. That's such a ridiculous statement, you know? You hear people say boys will be boys, often in defense of bad behavior by boys and men, right? But you know what? It's really an anti-male statement. To say boys will be boys is really anti-male, because what it suggests is that boys are not moral agents, that men can't really think for ourselves. We're just kind of overcome by these hormones, and we just... And I think we need to hold men to a higher standard. We need to hold young men to a higher standard in a positive way, not a negative way, not like you're bad, but more like we expect more of you, because I think boys and men can either sink to a lower standard or rise to a higher standard. And I think we need to set the bar higher. I think we need to say we expect more from you, from us. And I think adult men working collaboratively with women need to be saying this over and over again in whatever settings we can. Being a man who stands up for justice and stands up for anti-violence and stands up with women and against oppression, that's not being a weak man. He's not pussy whipped. That's being a strong man who believes in justice and freedom and equality and all the things that so many people say they believe in, but who actually has the whatever it takes to actually put it into practice. And by framing it in a positive way, we're challenging men in a positive way to rise to the better angels of their nature, as Abraham Lincoln said. And I think a lot of men and young men can respond to that.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.